I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us tonight. Kevin and Sam here, and today we're going to talk to Peter House, and we're going to talk about the beauty of mathematics. And we want to take a look at it in a fun philosophical context. We're going to look at what mathematics really is, why it's important to you. We're going to look at chaos. We're going to look at the psychology of probability. And we also want to look at algorithms and how those technologies are actually changing the way you live your life and the choices and daily decisions you make, and you may not even be aware of it. We got a lot of fun stuff to cover, and we hope that you'll chime in with some questions on Facebook. You can find us on Bridge to Everywhere. Just type that in the search, and you'll find our page.
Hi, everybody. Sam here, and I want to give you a little bit of information about Peter before we start. So Peter House first became interested in mathematics after reading Chaos by James Gleick, A Survey of Chaos Theory. After finishing Chaos, he subsequently changed his major from political science to mathematics. He completed his bachelor's degree in mathematics in 2007 with a minor in philosophy. His major interest in mathematics is in exploring the underlying relationships between objects, particularly around the spaces that we create in our communities, data, and other seemingly unconnected portions of our lives. Peter lives in Palmer with his wife and two daughters, and I think he wants to say hello to everybody.
I do. My daughter Josephine is patiently waiting by the radio, so I just want to say hi, Josephine. I love you, and I can't wait to see you this evening.
So one of the things we want to start with, because when we were talking about doing this show on math, it brought up a lot of interesting questions from people. And math, we discovered, is one of those words that's kind of like the word God or the word love. It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And many people have misconceptions about what math is, some of it because they think that it's something that they're not good at. You know, a lot of people will actually act proud that they can't balance their checkbook. So it's a subject that people have a lot of, we can call it charge around it. So what we want to do for the next hour is have you set aside everything that you think that you know about math and mathematics and how you think it affects your life, and just keep an open mind and listen, and we're going to explore a few things. And again, as Kevin said, if you have any questions, we'd love to take your questions on the air. So please post them to our Facebook page and we'll share them with Peter.
Yeah, and Peter is always inspired us in any conversation that we've had. When he starts speaking about mathematics, it opens up into this, you know, incredible three-dimensional world with beauty and wonder and awe. And I'm just so excited to have you here on the show, Peter.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here with you.
So let's get started. What do you want to talk about first?
Well, I really like the comparison there with God, love, and mathematics. And I think it's really true that like God, like love, everybody's experience with mathematics is unique and can be positive or negative depending on how they go. And I think that mathematics, probably like music, are probably the two subjects that people are really most sensitive to when it comes to instructors. And your path can be shaped by instructors who maybe didn't connect with you in a way that really made sense at that time, at the maturity level. You know, going through school, you have so many different people progressing at different maturity levels. And so you're sort of bound, in a sense, by those legacies of teachers, and they can really affect your ability to see and gain a certain sense of wonder that you know, looking at mathematics can give, even in the simplest, easiest of topics. You know, that teacher can still be there, lurking in the background.
Can you remember any teachers that stood out from when you were growing up in high school or in elementary school, or, you know, something that really, you know, where it either affected you that way, like, oh, I won't be interested in this subject at all, I hate this, or wow, that's really inspiring? Anything about math in particular?
I had a teacher, Mrs. Combs, in my sophomore year, that I was a very poor student. I was getting a D or an F or whatever, and she set me aside and she said, you know, I know you're better than that, and I expect you to do better than that. And my grade, of course, responded accordingly. So, yeah, there are always teachers. Hopefully, you know, of course, there were teachers along the way that didn't jive with the way that I learned. But I think it's a matter of perspective. You want to tap into the teachers that believed in you and find their thoughts and use those to help you with math. And I think that there's something that's actually about mathematics that to pause for a second and really think about how we improve our lives. I think there's three sort of general buckets of improvement. And the first one is efficiency gains. You're kind of going through your work every single day, and you find a shortcut, and you can do it a little bit faster. Those things we just kind of figure out on our own. Then you have invention, where you're solving known problems in new ways. And then you have opening of a new semantic space, learning a new language, understanding the world in new concepts, and that's the hardest one, right? These are all sort of tiered in terms of effort. And learning a new language, like French or something like that, or mathematics, really takes a lot of effort. And so it's one of those things that if you feel like it's a lot of work, it's because it is. And even people that may seem like they're really good at it, just like runners, just like athletes, they work at it. And it's very difficult.
And what exactly is mathematics? I mean, can we actually define that and say what is this universal language that seems to be reflecting principles in the observable natural world? Is there a one sentence or a few sentences you can use?
And before you go there, I want to add in that there's a book called Innumeracy, which is talking basically about numerical literacy by an author. His name is John Allen Paulos, and he talks about the misconception that math is only about computation. And he said math is as much about computation as writing is about typing. So there's a lot more in there than just, you know, than crunching numbers and coming up with a result.
Oh yeah, I'm reluctant sometimes to beat up the education system too much because it's not an area that I have expertise in. But it does feel, I remember when I was so glad when I broke free of the bonds of calculation into real mathematics. It was such a liberating moment. And it's something that I don't know if we need to address at the national or the local level, but to leave that behind and leave that to the machines was so wonderful. And you're right. Mathematics is really about managing ideas and theories. And Kevin, to speak to, you know, everybody has my sort of pithy statement is that mathematics is a means for dealing with complexity. If you imagine how difficult it can be to fly, right? There's a lot that happens in flight, but there's a few things that really matter more than everything else. And mathematics is a tool that allows the information, the details that don't matter as much to fall away. And we can focus in on the things that matter, like thrust and lift to get off the ground. And so mathematics does give us that tool. It gives us that language to communicate, to simplify very complex things into a way that actually can be repeatable. Now there's airplanes everywhere, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, and that brings in the question of probability and how we understand and relate to complex systems and try to orient ourselves. And I mean, how do I know I'm not going to be the person on that plane that crashes? Right? Because there's a certain probability.
Yeah.
So that's another way that numbers are actually used in mathematical calculations is probability. Now, of course, the probability is very, very slight, but do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I can say that, first of all, let me clear the air, that probability wasn't the highest scoring classes that I had in college. But and it's funny, that's the thing that I find myself tutoring the most these days, is probability. But there is this, there's this question of immediacy that probability in terror, right? You have this, there's almost like this low probability, high consequence event perception that occurs when you step on that airplane, even though it's catastrophically low. I remember having to go through some probability problems, and you know, four engine airplane I think had like a, given the rules that they had set, the sort of in the word problem was like 0.001% chance of crashing or something like that. So even with a very rudimentary, simplified problem that was contrived, the odds were very low. And yet when you hop in the car, right, we all hear this, right? You hop in the car, your odds are much higher that you're going to end up in a wreck. But there's a sense of control. There's a sense that even if you were in a wreck, it wouldn't be the end of things, right? But yet because of the, what I would say, the sharp curve downward, right? If you lose control in a dynamically stable system like an airplane, there's this sense that it's complete loss of control. And I think that's what elevates that probability, that sense of probability, and inflates it falsely to where it would hop in the car, drive, 10 miles over the speed limit, who cares, right? Live forever. Get on the plane, you feel a little bit more sheepish. I think that it just has to do with a little bit of the psychology.
I think it's really one of the, I had a conversation with my mom, and that was kind of in the book, in the Innumeracy book, there's a reference to this particular conversation about probability, and it could be a million to one that something would happen to you, and somebody thinks that they're negating that argument by saying, yeah, but what if you're the one? That somehow that negates the argument. So I think that's really, it's a way in which we're personalizing, I think, the experience of, well, what if it happens to me? that doesn't actually negate the fact that the probability was still a million to one. It was still a high probability that you were the one that got hit by lightning, right? But it doesn't mean there was any less, that lowers that actual probability number.
Yeah.
Right?
And I think that to get into the, I really, what if it happened to me? You think about lotteries, right? And you think about the thought is that if everybody has equal odds, the game is fair. And that's one way of perceiving it. Like, you sort of imagine that you and, 50,000 other people are sitting down for a game of Monopoly and you're all rolling the dice. But the reality is in those kinds of things, though, you have really two people. You have you and not you, and not you has a much greater chance of winning than you do.
Right. That's an interesting way of thinking about it.
Just two people.
Uh-huh. So I want to get back to where you found your new interest in mathematics was reading the book Chaos.
Yeah.
What was it about that book that really sparked your interest? And I know a lot of people's concept of chaos theory is a butterfly flaps its wings in the Amazon and, there's a hurricane off the, Gulf Coast in Florida. that's my basic understanding of chaos theory, that small things can have, if they're multiplied over and over again in certain ways can have huge huge consequences that are not necessarily understood, even though you could maybe do the mathematics of that butterfly flapping its wings in the Amazon somewhere, but the fact that there's some major event that comes out of it, it's not necessarily, it doesn't seem to have a linear, it doesn't really follow necessarily. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so that actually invokes, the word linear there invokes much of what chaos theory is about, is nonlinear dynamics and variables that impact each other. And I have to confess, I'm not an expert on chaos theory. I did happen to have a chance to speak to a German professor who was here for a chaos theory conference, I think around 2000. That was amazing. I was working the front desk at the Hilton, and he comes over to me and he saw the book, and he said, okay, you're going to come over to the restaurant and you're going to sit with me. And he saw some hesitancy, of course, because I was a young man in the service industry, and that level of empowerment just isn't present there. You're kind of young and unsure of yourself. And he looked at me and he said, "No, you're only going to have one chance to talk to me. So you're going to take your break right now, and you're going to come talk." And so we actually sat for more than an hour. And he traced out, he was working on salmon populations. As we know, we often thought that, at least historically, we often thought that populations tend to be in equilibrium, that they'll tend to an equilibrium, that you have these large spikes and that they continue to get lower and lower and lower, and then eventually they sort of just kind of hover around the axis, right? If you can sort of imagine a line, and they reach equilibrium with the rest of the environment that they're occupying. And that turns out that that's not the case. In fact, this is the first time I learned the word bifurcation, was that there's a point, and they can find it, where the population growth and decline actually just goes through the roof crazy nuts. And so it's really changed the way that people perceive predator-prey relationships and all of that. But really, chaos theory, I think, really looks at the fact that much of what happens in the world isn't clean. At the time, they were only able to be able to predict about a cubic inch of turbulence for a second. So, there's these things that happen in the world that impact our lives that aren't clean to model, but that they do impact our world.
And weather is one of them. This came out of looking at weather patterns and how they change globally and how hard it is. So, like, on a given day, you can predict something, but if you're trying to look a week out or, 2 weeks out, forget it.
Right, yeah. The Lorentz attractor mm-hmm. was what came out of that. In fact, I think now you can download that as a screensaver.
Uh-huh, yeah.
To speak about algorithms. But, it's interesting that, the Lorentz attractor looked at that days tend to follow a pattern, similar but not the same, right? So you have this sort of spiral that occurs that tend to sort of follow a path, but not exactly.
And then if you add one little variable into the system, how it's going to show up a day out or 2 days out or 3 days out or 4 days out, the longer that variable's in the system, the more change it affects, right?
Yes. You have small perturbations to a system that can have consequences that are amplified throughout the system itself.
So what other ways? So we're talking a little bit about weather. So how would you bring that into somebody's life? Like, how does chaos theory operate? Other than having a toddler running around in your house is probably a good example of chaos theory. But how does chaos theory show up? Like, why should we care about chaos theory?
Well, I think it goes to having a sense of wonder, and that is probably the. You're not going to have some sort of, you may, if you're really good or find a good niche, find some sort of professional application for chaos theory. But I think what it does do is it gives you an appreciation for all of the small things that occur around you and how small things can have great consequences. We see this in many portions of our lives, right? Small habits, such as exercise, can have huge catastrophic changes in a person's life, because it turns out that you end up balancing your checkbook more often if you exercise. So you can sort of get this appreciation by just appreciating chaos theory that not all great things require great effort. And I think that that's probably just a general takeaway that a person can take away without having to get a PhD in mathematics to get there.
And it sounds like you can't necessarily draw a conclusion about what the effect, what you're doing right now in this moment is going to happen, out into the future. So you can't necessarily say, oh, that didn't matter. You can't really say that anything you do does matter. You can't say that anything you do doesn't matter, though you don't really have the ability to see that far out in the future. So really anything can affect and change anything else. Right?
And I think about that as it relates to human relationship and how, what does it matter if I smile at this person that I just happened to walk past on the street? Now, I could say, doesn't matter at all, one way or the other. And if I imagine myself to live in a little bubble, just in my own little individual world, if I smile at this person, I'm going to be a nice guy. And, maybe I'll feel a little bit better, and maybe that person will feel a little bit better. But if we actually step outside of this sort of narcissistic bubble and say, every effort towards positivity, every effort towards giving could only, really amount to something positive out in the world. But if I have to see an immediate result, if I have to see a linear, relationship, some feedback loop that comes back right away, my world is going to be very fragile, and it's not going to actually really reflect reality. So it seems like if we take this principle of chaos and the significance of human choice, our capacity to choose, we're co-creators of what's unfolding. And if we approach our life this way, that some, and I, if I understand right with chaos, is that something more complex and integrated emerges from something that's less complex. So it's like somehow complexity emerges from simplicity, but it, at the very essence of it is always simplicity. And so I kind of reflect that back into human terms, is how we are in the world. There couldn't be anything more simple than just a choice in the moment to be a certain way. And of course, in our field in healthcare, that's just the foundation of everything.
Wow, that's really powerful. And I think that really drives it so many different aspects. I mean, we are embedded in a physical world. Some things are ruled by linear dynamics. Some of them are ruled by nonlinear dynamics. And these efforts, very small, don't tend to come back generally right away, right? I mean, it's sort of almost like the broken window theory. If you think about crime and cleanup of crime in an area, one of the first ways to alleviate crime is to start cleaning up the place, right? It's not chasing down the murderers, but really just focus on cleaning up the graffiti, getting those broken windows cleaned, putting some sunshine on your community, and that changes. The crime rate will begin to decline. There are these efforts that we can make that are indirect, that will actually reach at the results that we're looking for. And you just have to have the sense of that you're not going to have an immediate return, but that you'll get there. And you just have to shine a bit of positivity, and you'll get at it.
Yeah,
I was just having a conversation with someone this afternoon about that, about how do you change what's going on in third world countries, and what you do is you educate the women. I mean, that's, you put all this effort into educating the women in the country, and that changes actually everybody's life status. Mm-hmm. So, and again, that's something that it's like work that you're putting in over time, but the statistics are there, and they show it time after time again. If the women in the community are more educated, and they're making different choices, and they're not choosing to have, you know, 9, 10, 11 babies, you know, that like they start to have control over their lives, and the whole community changes. So, but like you said, it's not just, well, we're just going to bring in money and give everybody stuff so that they have money and stuff, and then everything will be better. That doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah, throwing capital at a problem almost never really returns the results you're looking for. I really like that, and I've heard that before. Another one that I've heard as well is that a way to double the income for a local population is to throw up cell phone towers. That people they're easier to communicate. They have greater chance to talk to each other, and so what'll end up happening is a local fisherman can avoid a bad day at the market by calling his cousin in the city. And so they're finding that more so than throwing in factories or any of these other sort of modern accoutrements that we tend to think around infrastructure, is that just throw up some cell phone towers and see what people do with them and what they create out of that. And it turns out to be very powerful and life-changing for them.
So my question when we're having this discussion is like, so, well, how does this relate back to math? And so we're talking again about relationships, like mathematics of relationships, like what governs relationships, and what governs what drives economies, what moves us forward. So this is what we're talking. So we talked a little bit about mathematics of relationships. Is there anything else that you want to say on that particular topic?
Well, I think in terms of, of course, that's the one that happens to be the subject that I have the most interest in.
Great.
Surprise. You know, the chaos theory was my entry point, but it wasn't something that stuck with me for very long. I think either because the mathematics itself was too complex, or that the subject matter itself wasn't something that stuck well with me. But it was that sort of gateway drug, I suppose, that got me into the things that I'm interested in now, which tend to be the mathematics around relationships. And so what I really started looking at was, I started out with databases, and I started looking at people. And I took a class called Discrete Methods, and they started out with a very interesting problem, which was the Seven Bridges of Konigsberg. And this is a very interesting problem that started back in the day. I would say, it let people know that I don't know Euler's history very well, so I won't use the date, but there were seven bridges, and people would go skating on the weekends. And people would walk around them. And Euler was, of course, a great mathematician, and they wanted to know if you could walk across the bridges once, across each one, traverse all seven bridges, but never cross one twice. And he looked at it, and it turned out that no, it's not possible. In fact, that was the first thing that we got to do was the teacher handed out a bunch of basically small diagrams, and he challenged us to draw. And so we're sitting there drawing, trying not to go back over a bridge, and he let us flail helplessly for about 5 or 10 minutes. And then he turned and he's like, "It's impossible." Welcome to combinatorics.
Welcome to what?
Combinatorics.
Combinatorics, and what's that mean?
It's the mathematics of combinations, of counting, of relationships. It really looks at finite systems, and instead of really what we look at today is modern mathematics, calculus of airplanes and traveling in cars, it focuses more on questions like, if you've got 7 unique teddy bears and 99 candy canes, and you've got a school full of kids to hand them out to, what are the possible number of combinations you can do that? So.
How do we determine that that's impossible, that with the 7 bridges problem? Like who does that get run through a computer program, and the computer program says, no way, you can't do this? Or is this, you know, is this lots of classrooms, everybody's trying to finally people give up? Like how do we know the answer is it's impossible to do it?
Because there's a series of theorems that once you put them in the right order and they led to each other, you could discover that it was an impossibility. That was sort of the birth of that study. So at first it was very crude. Now, of course, you look at these theories and they're much more elegant, but that's because we've had centuries to have steps and missteps, agony, failure, success. And we can put together a cleaner narrative. So when you open up that textbook, you can't discern the centuries of anguish that have gone into making it, but it's all in there.
Yeah, and you know, I wanted to ask about the evolution of mathematics. I mean, it's always been curious to me that, okay, so you start off with cavemen and women who are dividing up. You get 4 fish, I'm going to keep 4 fish. Or, you know, maybe some trading and bartering and some basic arithmetic. Then you know, how do you take that leap from arithmetic to algebra? And then from how does algebra become calculus? And from calculus, how did that become differential equations? And then how does that go into more abstract forms of algebra? And where is it all going? And is it just the sophistication of the human mind and its reaching out for predictive capacity that just leads to this deeper, more subtle understanding of the world? And is there much, much more to discover? And we're probably going to have to take a break in a few minutes, but just maybe
you can
a little.
Start. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep, you have 1 minute to start that, and then we'll take a break.
So can I just say wow for a minute?
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot there. And I think to start out, we do tend to generationally, at least in terms of the IQ test, I know that every generation advances about 8 points. That's why it's not considered an absolute measure. It's relative to the population, and they have to adjust it every generation. So there is at least some evidence of increasing capacity to understand these things. Some of it, of course, is emerging complexity. Some of it is actually the evolution of tools. Some great theorems we didn't have insight to until we actually were able to craft tools that were elegant enough for us to approach those problems. So, a lot.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that in a little bit here. We're going to take a break. We want you to write a question. Anything you might have about mathematics and how it applies to daily life, any questions, it'd be just great to hear from you on our Facebook page, Bridge to Everywhere. And we'll be right back. You in a few minutes.
KVRF Sutton, Radio Free Palmer. 89.5 on your FM dial, Big Cabbage Radio.
Support for Radio Free Palmer comes from the Palmer Downtown Deli. Palmer Downtown Deli provides free Wi-Fi in an informal, casual, conversational environment, or for just individual solace. Breakfast, lunch, or dinner dishes, wraps, specialty sandwiches, soups, or desserts, including gelato Italian ice cream, are offered along with coffee, espresso, tea, specialty waters or drinks. Music Arts Performing Live can be enjoyed every Saturday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. A comprehensive summary of Palmer Downtown Deli's menu options can be found at palmerdeli.com, and phone orders at 745-4100 are available as well. The Palmer Downtown Deli is located on South Alaska Street. The Palmer Downtown Deli, supporting community connectivity and community radio.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. We're here with Peter House, and we're talking about mathematics and how it's relevant to your life. And we were just talking about the evolution of mathematics, how we get from, you know, the kind of simple arithmetic to more complicated mathematics. And Peter was sharing that with us. And I also want to mention that in the book that I mentioned earlier, Numeracy, the author talks about how it's a common fallacy that you have to go through all that in order to have some sort of use of mathematics in your life, that you actually have to start from arithmetic and move up that. It's like hierarchical. The only way you're going to ever understand math and how it applies to your life is if you get to differential calculus. That's not necessarily the case. So if you want to address a little bit of that too, that would be awesome.
Sure. Well, if the exit exam for mathematics was requiring one to balance one's checkbook, I don't think that I'd have my degree. So I would say that there is a fundamental difference with arithmetic. And it is a very important skill to have, and it's actually one that, all jokes aside, I've actually taken steps in my own life to improve my ability to because you just need to be able to handle numbers like that. But really, mathematics doesn't require this long string of, you know, battery of problems of one flavor that leads into a battery of problems of another flavor that leads into a battery of problems of another flavor. It in fact, I would say that from the classes that I've taken, probably about three or four skills were actually necessary in the higher level classes. So I would say that doesn't tend to be the case, and you don't have to put yourself through a lot of agony. I think what's most important, if one's looking to expand their skills or their insight into mathematics, is to really find something that they're interested in, and find a book or some thinker that combines that material with a mathematical perspective. I don't think that a person starts gardening with a book on soil science, right? You tend to want to get into it because you have some base goal or base knowledge to work from, and that leads you into sort of a greater depth over time. And the same is true with mathematics as well. We started to talk a little bit about my own interests into the mathematics of relationships. Well, some of that actually grew out of both the experience that I had with my advisor at UAA, but also with my own interest in people generating and building these databases that modeled the world. And we were really sort of ossifying the way that we saw the world in a technical device, and what that actually said about how we see the world, how we codify it, how we extract and combine data from those. And that led into these greater questions about relationships between buildings, relationships between people, relationships between people and objects.
So really what you're saying is that when you, whatever interest that you have, as you kind of go into more and more depth with that interest and you want to learn more about it, you are going to find some mathematical way to codify what it is you're trying to learn about. But there's no sense in going in with I'm going to sort this out, because you don't really know anything about your subject yet. But as you start running into places where, oh, I don't really understand, and gardening is a good example, you know, why after, you know, 8 years have my tomatoes not exactly made it? I mean, that might be the time where you start going, maybe I need to think about, you know, like the intricacies of what's going on in the soil. But but it's not necessarily that you go into that with that sort of technical mindset that I'm going to understand all the intricacies. But when you run up against a place where you're like, I think there's more here, that math can be sort of the entree into that to find more depth.
Yeah, I've learned as through practical experience that if you lead with technicity and you lead with that as opposed to pure interest, you're going to tend to not be very successful in your endeavors. You might get things technically right, but it may be just egregiously wrong when somebody walks in and looks at it. What are you doing? No, put that over there. And, because you need context. And mathematics, especially from a practical perspective, requires some level of context. And there's, I would think, very few topics in the world that doesn't have some flavor of math that's attendant to it as you get deeper into the study of whatever you're looking at.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about building in particular, just construction work, and just how deeply embedded mathematics is. And if I started off just the mechanics, I just wanted to build something, that would be one thing. But if you have some vision of something that you want to create that's innovative, that's new, that's fresh, that's dynamic, and you're fueled from that passion and from that creative quality, you're going to enjoy the process of deepening your understanding of mathematics significantly, and you probably actually might discover something new along the way.
Yeah, I remember when I was remodeling my house, and I hadn't used trigonometry for years, and I had a pretty awkward angle that I needed to cut for, and I wasn't able to quite get the measurements I needed. And there's an old, a mnemonic device, silly old Harry caught a herring tripping over America, which gives you the, sine is equal to opposite over high, et cetera. So, I got the cut based off of that, little mnemonic device that it was pretty close. I mean, right, with construction, it's never perfect. It's your tolerance level. Your 1/16th or your 1/32nd of an inch, I think. Frank Lloyd Wright required his engineers and carpenters to be 1/32nd of an inch. It was very, very precise. But yeah, you that was like one of the few times I was like, I did practical math. Yeah, it was right.
So let's move into one of the things we all watched. Peter sent us a video from the Technology and Entertainment Design Talks, and it was about algorithms. And we've used the word once already, but we haven't really defined what that is. But we were talking about going from greater complexity in mathematics, and algorithms are pretty complicated. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what is an algorithm and how do algorithms actually affect our lives.
And would you say this is sort of the next leading edge of mathematics and applied mathematics?
Mathematics and logic, they're kissing cousins. You really can't talk about one without the other. Kind of goes back a little bit to what we were talking about with the early work that I was doing with databases and where that led out from. So an algorithm, to start with, is essentially a series of logic that proceeds in a certain sense that gives you an outcome of some input, some output. And the reason that we want to use them is because computers can apply them over and over and over again very quickly. You can see algorithms in play every single time you apply for an online loan, right? You sort of go in, you give your personal information, a few key details that they can use to pull information from different credit rating agencies. They sort of do some their own math, their own algorithms, right? They sort of mash up, see what the risk tolerance is for that kind of loan and whether or not you fit within those parameters, and they either give you the thumbs up or the thumbs down.
So let me simplify that a little bit. So I put in my data, and there's basically no human in there that's crunching that data. So you've got a program that's taking my information, and then it's making a judgment or an assessment based on the information that I put in, based on all the other people who have put in information, and what the outcome is generally going to be if the person has this level of income, higher than that or lower than that. So it's already in the computer, and then the answer is being spit out, and you're not having a conversation with another person. It's not like you talk to a loan officer and they said yes or no. It's just the computer spitting it back out at you, right? And I think we talked about the example of when you click on your Netflix account, that the computer, based on your rental history or based on your movie movie watching history, you're going to have a bunch of different titles that come up to the front and that Netflix thinks that you want to watch based on your previous watching history, correct? So that's another example of how it's just running there under the surface, and it doesn't really require an interaction with another human being.
That's right. And what they do, the algorithm's intent is to try to codify the general decision-making qualities of a process and do it in a machine way, so as to free up human time to do other things like face-to-face relationships, or sometimes to reduce headcount, or if nothing else, to be able to put it online, which many people. It's sort of the norm now to expect things to be online. If you're not online, it's just kind of a question as to why not. So the goal is to really find the pieces, that the key pieces of information that people would normally use to make a decision if they didn't know you from anyone else in the world and you walked in. These are the pieces of information that we would use to make a decision. This is what we're looking for. And then it usually spits out with a yes or a no answer, or maybe if you particularly customer focused, maybe a call us, see if we can work something out.
If you show up in the gray area, it's got a tolerance for gray area. This person is a solid maybe.
I think that would be a very advanced algorithm, but right. Impossible.
Well, three, or no, you don't get three possible states: yes, no, or maybe.
So. With algorithms, obviously the Google searches is one of the most prominently, everybody wants to understand Google's algorithms for how they're ranking search results. So if you are a business running a bed and breakfast in Anchorage and you want to come up on number one, how do you get on the top of that Google search? Because everybody knows, it's like who goes digging two or three pages into Google? You just look at the top 10, 15, 20 results, if that. So everybody wants to get on the top. And so Google's algorithms are determining the fortune or demise, really, of so many businesses. And they've got tremendous power because of that. And that's just one use of algorithms. It sort of gives a little bit of a window into how it's affecting economics and individuals. And also just what information actually does get presented. What if I want to learn something about Chinese medicine, and maybe a particular technique, or about a physician, from a century ago, what information is actually posted in my query is going to determine what kind of knowledge I can actually gain, conveniently and fast. So it's shaping the information that we actually are building and our perspective.
Well, not only that, I just posted something on my Facebook page a few days ago that showed just the way that you word your query to Google will give you a whole different set of answers. So if you use proper grammar when you ask Google a question, it'll spit out one set of answers. And if you use improper grammar and you use shortcuts like you're texting, you're going to get a whole other set of answers. So there's some algorithm in there that's sorting that out. So whether or not, and somehow somebody figured out the mathematics of that and put that in that program. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and it really extends to so many different things, and there's a really an interrelationship with the way that we behave online and the way that these algorithms react. Of course, the Google one's a really great example. Another one is that your search results tend to sort of get into confirmation bias. So if Google knows a little bit about your search history and you Google for politically sensitive terms, you're likely to receive results that match what they believe your political viewpoint is.
Wow.
Well, that's really interesting.
And they're not the only ones that do it. I mean, mm-hmm. It's this great problem of you want to customize your results to people, because not everybody wants the same thing. But it embeds a certain level of weakness.
And bias. Then if I'm a reporter and I'm doing search, I'm using Google as my main search engine, and Google's been noting the kinds of things that I search for, then how am I going to get necessarily unbiased information from both sides if I'm only getting information from the one side that Google thinks that I want? Yeah, I might be really interested, but I might write a story that's actually incorrect because I haven't gotten both sides of the information.
So. I'll have a very biased perspective, and I'll feel quite authoritative
right.
about it.
Yeah.
But it's actually been shaped by somebody else, and that somebody else would be an algorithm. That's a little scary because, ultimately we want as many perspectives. The more perspectives that we can include in our worldview, the better decisions we can actually make. And if we're being fed a biased perspective that's being shaped by a different agenda, and we don't even know it. And of course, this is the media, but if it's starting to, move into the distribution of knowledge through a medium that we begin to really trust, the internet and that, then it really should raise some causes for alarm.
Yeah, and there is a consequence. Before I switched out of political science, there was a pithy statement that one of my professors made that I thought was really true. He said that studies have shown that Americans, by and large, when shown evidence that has an opportunity to shape their worldview, they're more willing to accept and bring that new piece of information and alter their views based upon it than other citizens and other governments across the world. And there is a risk, I would say. It's hard to tell because we're really in blue water territory. We're uncharted waters. Things are changing. Neurologists are looking at the effects of abundance of data and information and algorithms upon the way that we think, and we're uncertain about how the mind is changing. There's just a lot that's happening very quickly. We don't quite have a grasp of it yet, but it will be interesting to see what the long-term impacts of having ready information available at your fingertips that actually can just reinforce your current beliefs as opposed to expanding them to account for different perspectives, different information.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking about Facebook and how is the feed of friends showing up on my page? Like I open up my Facebook page and there's always, I'm really fortunate to have I've got Facebook friends from all over the world, and most of them are really inspired people that are looking at community, culture, spiritual evolution. And so this is my reality. It's like I see this feed and it's so positive and uplifting, and I'm learning so many perspectives. And then another day, a different, every now and again, maybe there's other friends that are more into fishing or into, sports.
Or maybe complaining about who cut them off.
Or what
kind of a day they're having.
More mundane concerns that they're posting on their Facebook page. And, immediately I'm like, hey, I'm getting cut off here. And it's just funny because that really is shaping. Every single friend that I have is posting this illumination and introducing me to new philosophers, new ways of thinking, new things that are happening in the world, people doing amazing things. It really reinforces our own efforts. And I just see how important that is. But there's some other mechanism, an algorithm out there that's actually determining what feed I see, and that's actually affecting my day. I don't know. I feel a little funny about that, but I think it's interesting.
Yeah, there's the impacts of algorithms in our economy and our personal lives are so vast that I think it is going to be one of the areas where there's going to be a lot of learning. I don't know the exact percentage, but most transactions on the stock market aren't made by human beings anymore. They're algorithms that are managed. So you have a set of very smart, very intelligent people. Turns out most of them tend to be former physicists from the Cold War who are doing this work. That's actually a bit of there's a small crisis in the world of education right now, because universities are having a hard time competing in the financial markets for the best minds, because the salaries that you can offer and the lack of tenured positions for mathematicians and physicists pale in comparison to what you can do on Wall Street.
And these are people who are actually writing the algorithms you're talking about? Yeah.
Right. The algorithm, it's that math just applied over and over again.
Right. Yeah. But you have to have, in order to write an algorithm, you have to have a pretty good understanding of the subject matter that you're writing about. So one person has to have done that work at least once. Like one human being has to have crunched that information through. And then once that's done, that algorithm can just sit there and do its thing over and over again. I know in that video that you sent us, it was talking about some of the algorithms on the stock market had names. The video was talking about how people were trying to see that the transactions were happening so fast on the stock market that people wanted to get their algorithms closer to the actual stock exchange, so that they were actually putting up whole buildings just to get their particular algorithm in that, so that it could have like 1 nanosecond faster of a chance to respond to that trade. Yeah, to respond to the market. Is that the truth?
Yeah, well, as far as I know, the hauling out of buildings, because the space that's devoted to housing humans doesn't generate nearly as much revenue as it does that you can just put in a stack of servers that house and feed these algorithms. But there's a lot of things, and it's just a huge topic. There's a lot of consequences that we haven't uncovered. How much energy, exhaust, if you will, is used in feeding and maintaining these algorithms. I know that evolutionarily speaking, I heard somebody once say that the most expensive thing that humans did was develop a brain in terms of calorie requirements. I imagine that algorithms are probably very similar in the sense thinking is a very expensive task, especially if you're doing it very fast over and over again. I don't have the numbers for that. I think it'd be a very compelling study. You have data exhaust, right? We move through these digital worlds, leaving a wake of information behind us that we aren't really sensitive to. So what are the consequences of that? As we move throughout the web, you're leaving bits and pieces of personally identifiable information. I'm not trying to be
We talked about a couple of weeks ago with Dr. Nick Begich about, you know, what the implications for the fact that there really isn't privacy the way we used to understand privacy. If we're thinking about privacy in terms of like a 1950s idea of like you can just close the curtain and nobody can see what's going on, that's not the way it is anymore. Like what you just said, every single transaction, every single search, every single click to a website, all of that is leaving a data trail, and somebody can go behind you and sweep up that data trail, kind of like somebody could go through your garbage in the 50s. And find out about you.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that's different about that trash is you'd expect that trash would eventually decay, but you have something that is infinitely copyable, infinitely distributable, and that changes the game a little bit more than some geolocal trash that you found in some that you might be able to use to sort of slipstream into the gossip network. Now you're able to distribute this and combine it with other personally identifiable information, which gets fed into an algorithm, which then might decide your employability or something of that nature.
I read a story once about somebody who was trying to, it was a group of people who thought it would be, I think it started out as funny and then it turned out to be sort of a like an act of defiance. They took, when you go to a supermarket, you get a frequent user card, that you get at Fred Meyer that you swipe every time, and so that the company knows what you are buying and they can send you coupons specific to what you're actually buying. It was a group of people that all called themselves Donald Duck when they signed up for the card. So like 50 or 60 people who had the same card that went to the same place, and then they bought crazy things with it, trying to skew the company's numbers, just to try to, whoever's looking at that data was, trying to, make them a little bit crazy for what they were doing. But really, we really don't have control. I mean, it's kind of funny to think that you could, we can mess up the computer a little bit, but we really can't.
Yeah, in the vast sea of data, that is just an anomaly.
It's negligible, yeah.
Yeah. Eric Schmidt at Google said something that was very telling. I don't know how, I'm sure people have actually determined the veracity of it, but that in the year 2011, I believe, that we generated as much data as the dawn of civilization up to 1997. So in 1 year, we essentially doubled the amount of data that was present on the planet. So small efforts like that are immensely amusing, but really in the sea of data that we're awash in. And it introduces great problems of span of control. It's too much for humans to even begin to sift through. So what do we do with it? How do we how do we kill it? How do we, you know, delete data, right? Because data doesn't rot. It doesn't stink.
Right.
It doesn't get in your way when you go to the restroom. Uh-huh. So, how do we manage these problems with this vast generation of data, and how they're being consumed by algorithms?
Fascinating. And I wonder, you know, maybe quantum computers and that next generation of computational technology will provide some answers. But one thing on the personal level I can think about, and you said, you made a comment a year ago where you said, yeah, the future really is going to be about data dieting, you know, and I thought, oh my God, that's great, because really, I mean, I'm just enormously overwhelmed by the amount of data and information I want, you know, and so I've got never before a year ago did I have 30 browser windows open at one time and like maybe 14 Word documents where I'm actually copying and pasting information that I really want to learn and understand. And all of this is just being made possible through the network on Facebook, where I'm being introduced to new ideas, insights, and it's broadening our professional capacity, skills, and our abilities in the community. And so there's this enormous wave of information, but I notice that I can almost feel the cells in my brain at their threshold of absorption, you know, capacity, absorbing capacity. And I just wonder what innovator is going to come up with a way for us at the individual level to extract the relevant information really in an efficient way and help us actually integrate it in an effective way.
Well, it'll probably be an algorithm that helps us manage it, because it's just outside of our own control, at least from the direct level. We have to, what we're good at is telling machines what to do, right? Gary Kasparov is sort of our generation's version of John Henry, right? So computers now are just better at these things than we are, and we'll probably need to invent them. I suspect that information and sort of becoming a glutton of information will maybe replace materialism in a certain sense of looking at trying to fill some sort of vacuum in our lives. The access to information and that dopamine squirt we get every time we refresh a page or something like that, and we get that new piece of information on Facebook. Those are things that we're going to have to find a way to tackle. We've never lived in an era where an abundance of information was available to us for such little effort. You go to the library, you had to drive, and you had to look. And then you had to read. These days, a lot of that is really just compressed into almost a single event of logging on and searching.
It's pretty amazing. One of the, in that book, Innumeracy, I mentioned, he lists five different fallacies of mathematics. And one of the fallacies is that math somehow limits our freedom. You know, and after this conversation, it's clear that it does nothing of the sort. I think the author's response to that was the word balderdash. You know, look at what's possible with math.
Now, I'm sorry to say, but I only now just am getting a post here for a question, and it's going to be a long one, so maybe we can reply on the Facebook. But the question is, hello, I'm enjoying your show. How does our increasing understanding of complexity relate to the ability of the individual to make sense of the world around us? I.e., has it been said that Aristotle was the last person to know everything there was to be known during his time? Do you expect knowledge to undergo a compression or an explosion as a byproduct of the science of complexity? And I think we're kind of talking about this. But any last comments about that before
and
we
can
close?
You answer that in 15 seconds?
No. So I guess the answer is yes.
Yeah, and John, thanks. That's John Brickley's question. Thanks for posting that. And if there's anything else that we can add, we'll post that.
And we'll get
a
response from Peter and put it on the Facebook page.
I can certainly reply on Facebook.
Great, wonderful.
So for anybody that wants to follow up, I know you've got a blog. What's the way to find you?
Well, there's a couple of blogs that I manage. I think the best way, one is very specific to mathematics and databases. That one's just called Cold Logics. But the easiest way is just to hit me at peter.house@gmail.com, and any questions I can certainly answer, and I would love to have conversation.
Great. Thanks so much for joining us. Next week we'll have, or 2 weeks out on Monday, we'll have Dr. Kevin Del Duca, and we'll be talking about his experience as an emergency room physician. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everyone. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links, and resources from our guests and show topics.